My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. Well, our meeting's half over. I want to thank the first six speakers. And I don't know that I would have introduced a speaker that way, Pat, if you will just say this member is a member of, person's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, usually kind of gets it. I'm going to tell you a few things about Pat. If you will go to the southwest corner of Fulton County Stadium on ball game nights, you'll notice a rather corpulent fellow hawking boiled peanuts. I don't know anyone who peddles more boiled peanuts than Pat from Marietta, Georgia. Here, Pat, come on. I'm glad to be here tonight. I'm glad to be a member of the group at the Atlanta Roundup. It's a pleasure to be here. I've had a very fine time here. Some of you may know, I came down a little early with my friends Bill W. and his wife Barbara Wright. He's anonymous, she isn't. And we three are kind of Civil War buffs, and we started early on Wednesday morning and tromped over the battlefields at Chickamauga for most of the day, and then went up to Missionary Ridge and Lookout Mountain, and Thursday morning we were at Orchard Knob, which was the advanced Union position in Chattanooga. And then we traced Sherman's march down through Georgia, tromped around Kennesaw Mountain. Bill's great-grandfather fought for the South in these battles. My great-grandfather fought for the North in those battles. So he smiled as we went through Chickamauga, and I laughed around Missionary Ridge. But we had a very good time, and our guide and driver was the ineffable Bill Roop, who, if ever you're not grateful for anything, you ride with Bill, and after about four left turns, you're grateful to be out of the goddamn car. Here comes a big truck. Watch me scare that son of a bitch. And Bill always feels comfortable. His side is safe. Yeah. And then we came here for this fine convention. I really have enjoyed it. I enjoyed Thursday night's meeting. I enjoyed the dinner the committee put on for us. And the Thursday night meeting with that alligator wrestler from down on the Georgia border. I just think that's one of the great lines of all time. It's when someone's got a gun and they call you, don't answer it. James?
Yes, sir.
That cheered me up. And Harold last evening, who always gives a fine talk, does a great deal of good work around the middle of Texas. I get through his hometown from time to time because the state insane asylum is just a few miles from there, and I go back for alumni reunions. And I'll tell you something else about. I told him this last night. He and George have something in common. They're both just good old boys, you know. What I have learned, if I've learned nothing else in the world, when somebody gets up there and just starts talking, well, now, I'm just a country boy. I don't know much about things. What I've learned is I put my hand over my wallet and back out as fast as I can. I'm about to be handled. Tell me all you want with the big city sharpies. You give me an old country boy every time. Well, now. And I very much enjoyed the charming Al-Anon speaker this morning from Lubbock. Gave an excellent talk. So there's another one. There seems to be a kind of a whole gun thing in this convention. something. Many of you weren't here, but she mentioned how she, her husband was slipping around AA and he was acting badly, and she went into her bedroom while he was in the bathtub and got a 38 and came to the bathtub and put it between his eyes and says, "You better be an alcoholic, you son of a bitch." And he had a spiritual awakening. I said, yeah. Took the first step and never looked back. And I very much enjoyed the Alcathon this afternoon. It was a fine Alcathon. I was there mostly for the middle of it, the ones where they talked on the promises, and that's always good to hear because it reinforces the things that can happen to us. They sound, if you're new, they sound like just some more baloney. In fact, I sometimes have to think about those promises. They must really be inspired because the man who wrote them in 1939, or late 38 or early 39, all of those things hadn't happened to him yet. He was kind of writing on spec. Now there's a lot of books, self-help books that are written on spec, and the things they mention never come true for anybody. What makes that book inspired is that he wrote things that were going to come true for hundreds of thousands of people, and they haven't even come true for him yet, all of them. And that sometimes it just strikes me what an inspired instrument that book is, because, you know, they talk about, well, the first 100 got together who were sober a year and they sat around and they wrote this book. And it wasn't quite that way. In the first place, there weren't 100 people sober a year. There had been something like 78, and they kind of rounded off the number to inspire people. And a great many of those 78 died drunk. And this guy wrote that, and he was surrounded much more by losers than winners. And he was writing things, he had no background in education or psychology or medicine or in anything. He had no background except being a failed stockbroker's assistant. And he wrote something that as was mentioned last night, that was, no one has approached that writing as a recovery program for alcoholics in the history of the world. People who have given their life to alcoholic research haven't even scratched that success ratio that he had. So it always seems to me that whatever else you believe in, you almost have to believe that book is inspired, because he did not know enough at that juncture to write that book. He wrote about a lot of things that he had not even seen yet, and they were there. Now, if you're new tonight, you may think, well, a guy 4 years sober should know enough to write that book, because 4 years sober is a long time. But when you get to be 4 years sober, you realize you're not as totally knowledgeable as you thought you might be. By the time you're 5 years sober, you kind of patronize people who are 4 years sober. You know, still going to meetings? By the time you're 10 years sober, you hate to send people 4 years sober for coffee because they'll screw it up somehow. No, I told you 2 sugars and 1 cream, you dummy. Yeah. By the time you're 20 years sober, you don't really want people 4 years sober alone on your property. Yeah. Nothing against them personally, but it's just, you know. And here's a guy sat down 4 years sober, surrounded by failure, and wrote a book that gets truer every year. It gets truer year after year. The hard part is to get through the time you need it. Because that's when you're too smart to accept it. As you get dumber, it gets truer, and it gets better and better. And so there are a lot of people sober. It's hard to remember. There are probably more people sober in this room tonight than are sober through all other therapies combined in the history of mankind, of people like us. It really is a staggering thing, and we just take it for granted. That's the nature of being a human being. Whatever happens, I take it for granted. Anything good I should have, anything bad is a bad break. And I completely forget the nature of my illness makes this absolutely miraculous. Before I came to AA, I tried many therapeutics, because I always felt from the time I was a young man on that I had been given a significant disadvantage in human relationships. I had been cursed with intelligence. And I used to said, why couldn't I have been born dumb like these people? And just, and I, the one compensating advantage I had was that I discovered when I was young too, that I had been given a gift, that I had been given the gift of almost instantly being able to identify crap heads when I saw them. When I was young, it took a handshake and a few words. As I got older, across the room, I could tell them, you know. In fact, that's one of the problems, is you get older, and they be the ones that pretended not to be crap heads show their true colors, and pretty soon you're just you're in a sea of crap heads. I think that's why people like me, and perhaps like you, when it's late at night and you're drunk and lonely, you have to call long distance. Yeah. If there's nobody around here I want to talk to, so and I tried a lot of therapeutics over 30 years ago. I was in psychoanalysis. I was a young executive, or starting to become a young executive, and I got into psychoanalysis. A lot of people put psychiatrists down. I never do that. I learned a great deal in psychoanalysis. In fact, today, I know that probably Harold, those old right-wing fascist AAs, don't agree with this, but I see a psychiatrist once or twice a week, and a lot of people say to me, why, if you think AA works so well, why do you insist on seeing a psychiatrist once or twice a week? And the answer is simple, because I've told him unless he comes to those meetings, I won't be a sponsor. That's all. The hell of it. I'm gonna put it in. As soon as I straighten him out, he's going to straighten me out. That's the deal we got. I don't look for a quick turnaround. I got into metaphysics. I did a lot of things. At one time, I don't like to brag, but I was going through some bad times. At one time, I got really caught up in metaphysics. Today, it's kind of a common thing, but in my day, just the searchers and the thinkers got into metaphysical understandings. And at one time, I was one, to the best of my knowledge, I was one of six people in the whole state of Texas who knew truth. And that's a heavy load to carry in Texas, I'll tell you that. It was almost a relief when they put me away in the Texas Insane Asylum, and I could set down this burden and just think about the next event, which Harold and I were talking about that last night. You know, it still sends a shiver to my spine when I get into I love Southern accent, but there's one phrase that when I hear it with a Southern accent, it just, my heart leaps in my throat. It sounds so innocuous. She says, "We're going to help you." That comes right before the shock treatment. You hold those two electrodes and say, "We're going to help you, boy." Why don't you go help somebody else over there? I read books. I read Nietzsche. I really did a lot of things. One of the things I did most of my life that was a great help to me in my emotional conflicts, I drank from time to time and had a few drinks I thought at one time I might have a drinking problem, but I went to an AA meeting almost 34 years ago, and I'm not one of those people. Those are people whose problem is alcohol. I heard that at my first meeting, and in addition to that, I was shocked by the general appearance of all. They were old, gray, burned out fools in their 30s and and when you're a young firebrand, a young rocket waiting to go, just waiting to find your afterburner, it really is not much of an inspiration to see some old goof up there. "Well, I drank night and day for many years. One day I walked through that door and I put the plug in the jug and I've just never been so goddamn happy." Yeah. It seemed to me that my problems were basic conflicts and emotions, and I worked on those emotions for years. And when all else failed, I drank a little bit because drinking gave me some relaxation. Drinking gave me some valve between my inside and outside, which was always the pressure spot. And my job was to learn how to handle it. I sometimes think that my handling of alcohol is very similar to modern man's efforts to harness atomic energy. You know, when it worked, it really works. The lights go on and the wheels spin, and but every so often you hit Three Mile Island one more time. What gauge didn't I check? And it's just a dreary thing to always be playing catch up. And my emotions were always intense. I always remember thinking that when I was a young man, I thought my case was different from other people, that my emotions were different. As I got older and read a lot about emotion, I discovered that there are other people with my emotions, but apparently they don't have the intensity of my emotions. Their symptoms are like mine, but they're not as intense. As though somehow a layer of insulation had been left off me, I felt. I remember telling a guy in a bar one time, I said, I get the feeling that when I came off the end of the assembly line, I got to the last operation where they're supposed to put on the insulation. And somebody said, hey, God. And I said, yeah. Ah, screw him. And so it always seemed to me I felt things too intensely. I felt I could spot rejections in a glance across the room. I could watch people just all the time. I fell into that classic trap, which I've talked about many times, but of comparing myself to others and wondering why I was different and never realizing that I was committing the classic comparative error that nearly everybody in the world does sometimes. People like us do it a lot because you do it when you're feeling insecure, but you do it a lot. And that is, you compare how you're feeling against how other people are feeling, and never once stop to realize that you are comparing your insides against their outsides. I am comparing my raw meat against defense mechanisms they spent 30 years building to conceal their raw meat. So as a result of that, when I'm feeling bad and I start comparing, and I can say, I can almost guarantee you the same thing, that you will never see anyone who looks as sensitive as you feel. You'll never see anybody who seems to have the anxiety that bothers you. Other people have anxiety, but, you know, they have reasons for their anxiety. The anxiety that's difficult to explain is when you can't think of a reason big enough for this anxiety. You can't even seek help for it. You know, I remember thinking, sitting in advertising agencies working, my boss, if he came in, said, well, Emerson, how are you doing today? What if I told him the truth? Oh, I'm afraid. What are you afraid of? Beat the shit out of me. I don't know. Just afraid. Sick with apprehension. You discover those are not the right answers in this world. How are you doing? Just fine. Just opening a vein to get out a little tired blood there. You won't see people who look as lonely as you feel. They get lonely, but their loneliness apparently can be overcome by getting in touch with someone and going to the show. The type of loneliness that I felt was unique unto me is the loneliness that strikes you most intensely in the middle of crowds of people. When you feel, there's something missing. And resentments and upsets and emotions. And I drank to relieve those emotions when the therapies I was currently trying didn't work. And sometimes I drank too much, and when I drank too much, I would from time to time fall into the hands of people, I'm sure most of you have, which just adds a crown of thorns to the whole crucifixion. People who want to talk to you for your own good. And they all say different things, but they all have one thing in common. They all have little thin blue lips. Now, this is for your own good. And sometimes they say things like, do you think your children would be proud to see you in this condition? And sometimes they say things like, How do you expect to stay part of the corporate team if you act so bizarrely? Or the one that everybody's heard, but you have such potential. When you hear that and you got to pretend to be interested, you're in trouble. So I was always playing catch-up, and sometimes I drank too much then, and sometimes I brooded, and sometimes I got to be kind of depressive, and I had a lot of ups and downs. I always wanted to be something. I wanted to be a good man in a good world, and my emotions would alter how things went, and I'd see things all differently. I had the ups and downs. I don't know a quicker way to say it. One spring, I was nominated to be Junior Chamber of Commerce Young Man of the Year in a suburb of Chicago. By the end of the same year, I was playing piano in a whorehouse in San Francisco. But I'm not putting that down. That's kind of fun for Lutherans, you know. Must be a party going on upstairs. And then I would reform again, because that's another thing about being a Lutheran. Lutherans can't enjoy evil very long, and it's just hideous, even those of us with a natural flair for it. I reformed, and I ran some guys, and they were going to Texas. I started all over again. I got a little job in a newspaper. And a year and a half later, I was working days in an advertising agency, writing ads. At night, I was directing a grand opera for the University of Texas at El Paso in the original Italian. Kind of fun watching Texans sing Italian. writing a weekly sports column for the newspaper, because I had a wide range of interests. And by the end of that year, I was in the Texas Insane Asylum. Not for drinking. I hadn't sunk to that, thank God. I was in there as a suicide. And the reason I was a suicide, in order to hold my job, I had to stop drinking. And for people whose problem is not drinking, when you use it as a therapeutic, and then you can't use it, it just leaves you... There's nothing to protect you against the sharp corners. You just... It gobbles you up, and the feelings get more intense. And one day, my family went off to church, and I just parked my car in the garage and turned on the motor and went to sleep and died. And funny, huh? When I get to the part where I get leukemia, you like that? I don't know why I say those things. Something about Georgia that brings out the worst in me all the time. But I, guy next door heard the motor running, kicked down the door and pulled me out dead. And they breathed up my nose and beat on my chest and examined me in the psych ward and determined I was a frightfully shattered schizoid personality, and committed me for an indefinite to life in the Texas State Mental Hospital at Big Spring, Texas, just outside of Harold's little town. And God, I thought I was depressed before. Jesus. something like that is your... That really is a bitch to work into your resume later. I'll tell you that. That's why most of us have holes in our resume that where things are written like self-employed during this year. Studying at a university that later burned down without a trace. In fact, when they saw on my record that I had I ran away, and they brought me back, and they gave me shock treatment starting then. After you get enough shock treatment, you don't run away much anymore. You just... Remember my name, buddy? I came up with those shock treatments, and they saw my record. I directed an opera at the University of Texas at El Paso, so my first therapy at that hospital was to direct the Christmas pageant that year, which was about a second grade level, so the whole student body could follow along, you know. It wasn't terribly intricate to direct, but the director's main job was just trying, if you could, keep the three wise men off the Virgin Mary. Just we just want to worship our clients. I started a hospital newspaper, but I never was going to get out, because I was getting upset with things, and Next year they put in the first alcoholic ward. I guess it was the first one in the state of Texas, the Big Spring, and I'd been in and out of AA for 6 or 7 years by that time, so I knew how to act like an alcoholic, you know. Give them a simpleton answer. I want an all-time sobriety. I want to return to the values I lost in the bottle. Mm-hmm. This old counselor. And I got to be a secretary of the group. Everybody else was there for 30 days, then they went home. I was there forever. I just... And it wasn't really as what you call a sincere group, you know. You sit next to the next meeting, next to the guy, say, what are you going to do when you get out of here, Fred?
I'm going to kill that bitch.
I finally got to be secretary of the AA group, and I eventually got out. And a year later, I was working in Dallas at the largest advertising agency in the South, and I was working on these ads. Some of you old people have read them, these old Elsie and Elmer ads for the Borden Company. People thought I'd learned my lesson, and later that same year, I woke up one morning, and I was on the floor of the Phoenix, Arizona drunk tank, and a guy had just got done kicking my front teeth out because he said I'd vomited on his bunk. Is there nothing sad to you people down here? See? It's bringing tears to my eyes, but oh, yeah. Oh. And I, that morning, I was very glad that I had, had been in psychoanalysis some years before that. Because once you've been in psychoanalysis, you always have a little additional insight and an understanding that most people never get. And that morning, I was so sick, I woke up and I couldn't even move my head out of the way of this guy's shoe. But I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, this son of a bitch is overreacting. When you can see things like that, it gives you a hint. But that's the way my life went. So one time I went down and I didn't bounce up and it went to hell, and I eventually followed the classic pattern. All this time I went to AA, and AA was nice. AA was a mystical place. You somehow quit drinking and things got better and became good. And by God, I quit drinking and things would get, there's a surge in not drinking, but eventually it drifts away and the same problems that are making you crazy come back. And you just have no insulation against it. And there's something not entirely intellectually satisfying to the questing intellectual, or imitation intellectual, in AA. I remember going to a meeting once and thinking, I'm going to have to just expose myself. Just let these people know. I just want you to know, I think I'm going crazy. It really is not totally gratifying to get an answer to that, like, well, you keep coming back. Seems to please the others. It don't please me. I got a bunch of hot checks out. If I don't cover them by Monday, they're going to garnish me my wages. I'll lose my job. What do I do? Well, you turn it over. It sounds good, but it don't work. I tried that once, and my higher power turned over to Sheriff Peter Pitchett. I went through quite a series of things. I went to jail off and on. In between times, I was being something. I was down and out. They told me in my first meeting that AA would change my life, and I was glad to hear that, because I'd been in jail twice, and you can't have that kind of a record and be an executive, really. That was my first meeting, and they were right. It did. After I came to AA, I went to jail 32 times. Yeah, that certainly made a significant change in my life. And AA is a nice place if you're a person whose problem is drinking. But it's a bad place if your problem is feeling and thinking. Because you just... Mysticism will do it for a while, but it just doesn't seem to be enough. And especially for idealists who gradually have become cynical. The most cynical people I know are ex-idealists, and they are the people who resist it the most. People, as they say, come from a good Christian home, who came from a belief, and they lost the belief, and they don't want to believe in nothing now. And So I had a very checkered career. I followed the classic pattern of losing my family. That isn't necessary, but I mean, I was young and strong, and I survived, and I lost my family, and my occupation, and my home, and my clothes, and my front teeth, and, you know, you can get other families and other homes, but like the book says, we are like men who have lost their front teeth. We never grow new ones. But if you're new tonight and you've lost some front teeth or lost some teeth, let me tell you something, give you a little hope. Once you get spiritual, they come back. That isn't technically true, but I want to give you hope. And I wound up one rainy day being 86th out of the midnight mission in Los Angeles, California. The only bad thing that didn't happen to me that I thought about, that I didn't think about, I never had to go to work to Bill Coveney's mill in Dalton, Georgia. We went there Thursday to visit that mill, and it really is a great 12-stepping operation. There's a guy that lays under a line, and the carpets come down, and the backing comes up, and he sits there smelling latex all day and poking it straight. And he just lays there for 8 hours, 10 hours in this heat. And all he does is smile. Just that latex goes in. How you doing under there? Just fine. I don't mind working double shift today, Mr. Coveney. I slipped him the 20 questions. But I really, it was down and out. And yet, as I stood outside of the midnight mission, 86, 108 pounds, no front teeth, everything gone, dying. If somebody came home and put a lie detector in my arm and said, are you an alcoholic? I would have said no, and that needle wouldn't move to flickered. I'm some kind of a strange guy, and I have strange aberrations, and I have problems and emotional situations. But alcohol is not really the problem. I wish to God it were, because I'd stop drinking. But drinking gives me a cushion. Drinking gives me a cushion. Drinking almost saves my sanity sometimes. And AA is not like me. And today, as you can tell, I survived, and I got more clothes than the T-shirt I had on then, and I stayed sober. In a couple of months, it'll be 25 years since that morning, and I've lived relatively comfortably, and everything is, you know, on the surface, a good life. But probably the most impressive thing I have said tonight, or I will say before I sit down, is that I said my name is Clancy Imeslin, and I'm an alcoholic. That is the single most difficult thing I've ever had to come to believe. I did not believe I was an alcoholic when I was drinking. I did not believe I was an alcoholic when I went back to that AA club to try to hustle some dough. And I didn't believe I was an alcoholic after I was sober. Because alcoholics are people whose problem is alcohol. If I could blame my problems on alcohol, I would be glad to be an alcoholic. But it isn't. When I get sober, instead of feeling the completeness I hear, a hole gets in my stomach and the wind blows through. The tensions come back and the anxieties and the depressions and the frustrations. And you can't blame that on alcohol. In fact, the best psychiatrist I ever knew told me I would probably have to take some form of medication as long as I lived because of the intensity of my mood swings. In fact, the only thing I ever thought I ever wanted to go back and do with somebody, I should have gone back to that psych ward where they committed me. I wanted to go back and take that psychiatrist that diagnosed me and sue him for malpractice. Because, you know, he defined me as a split personality. I should have just grabbed him and said, listen, you, if I could get my personalities down to two, I could make it from there. Yeah, right. It's this group therapy when I'm alone in my car. Now, how is stopping drinking going to help this? It isn't going to help it. It's going to make it worse. Now, if anybody ever tells you that stopping drinking is going to make your life better, let me suggest something to you. Not if you are like me or the other people who are like me. You wish it were. It is for a while, but not very long. Why? And the number one problem I had in my life with AA, and I'm sure most people have had, is you fall in that trap of thinking, why is it when I stop drinking, it doesn't get better? Now, you sometimes get the impression, AA, that you're here to solve your alcohol problem. In fact, you hear sometimes speakers talk, make it sound like it. They say, well, I was sober and it was just wonderful. Then I got drunk, I just went crazy. Then I got sober and it was just wonderful. Then I got drunk, I just went crazy. Then I got sober and it was just wonderful. Then I got drunk, I just, you want to say, why do you drink? You know, a person like you shouldn't drink. It was wonderful when I was sober, I wouldn't drink. And it, if you're one of those people whose problem is alcohol, if you're one of those people whose problem is alcohol, and your life is okay when you're sober, I'm going to revolutionize your life. Don't drink. Just leave your love donation for Reverend Harold here on the altar and move it out. Help keep he and I on the air. And the Gospel Tabernacle Choir. They come on at 10:30. We're dancing to them. But if it turns out that you suffer from what I suffer from, you may go to your grave, as way over 90% of alcoholics do, and never know what the hell was wrong. Never know what was really wrong, except that it almost worked out again and the bottom dropped out one more time. It isn't alcohol. It sounds like alcohol, and we talk a lot about drinking around here. But it's not alcohol. It's something called alcoholism. Now you say, what the hell is the difference between alcohol problem and alcoholism? It's some kind of a debater's trick to put a little three-letter suffix on. But that little three letters on the end, I firmly believe, is what makes people like me terminally ill, and on the other hand, gives me the only chance I will ever have to feel better again, if I can identify it. And there's a basic difference between an alcohol problem and alcoholism, I believe. And it's just this. If you have an alcohol problem, you stop drinking and you start to recover and no further treatment or therapy is required. But if you suffer from this thing called alcoholism, you may go to your grave and never understand this most important fact. Stopping drinking has no effect whatsoever on alcoholism, except to make it worse, to make it more painful. There's a surge in feeling better for being sober, but eventually it comes back. One of the hardest things that I had to come to understand, the natural state of sober alcoholics is anxiety and depression. That is the natural state. Anything apart from that is something has been changed. That's why people die from alcoholism. If stopping drinking was the answer, detoxes would turn out winners. Hospitals would turn out all winners. Toilets could turn out winners. You know, that's the classic American detox. You just kneel in the morning and gaze into those shimmering waters and waiting for an answer to surface somewhere. Say your morning vespers. Oh, God. That's the detox, boy. Your body is saying you are suffering from a high level of toxicity and we're going to reduce it by inducing a procedure called reverse peristalsis.
I haven't got time to hear that now.
One of the hardest things for me to understand is the deadly and mortal aspect of my illness. And most people, I'm in a position that most of you are not in, maybe very few of you. Almost every day I see alcoholics dying. And I see alcoholics suffering from the Korsakoff syndrome or brain damage. And so it isn't really hyperbole to me when I hear that in the book, alcoholism can drive you to insanity and death. But the people I see are only 3% of the alcoholics. Another 97% are living in Atlanta and Chattanooga and Bel Air and Santa Monica, Chicago, people who are still trying to keep it together. And no, they can't be alcoholics because they're not like the 3% that are visible. And it's a hard thing to understand. The nature of the illness. The nature of this illness. If I don't remember the nature of this illness, I'm liable to die from it. The nature of this illness is this. Sobriety eventually gets filled with the same tensions and conflicts and problems and frustrations that I have depended upon alcohol to ameliorate, and by God, I got no alcohol now. And it gets worse and worse. You get to a point, if you're intense, and I guess most of us are, where it really begins to gray out. I don't mean that the world is gray, but the greens and the new car is gray and the wife is gray and the children are gray and the job is gray. And you get up in the morning and it's just, you're like a bowstring, and you get to a point that is really almost unbearable, and you're fighting to keep it together. Scientists, you know, describe it well. Now, that doesn't make you an alcoholic, it turns out. There are millions of people who get just like that who are not alcoholics. They are known as intense or acute neurotics. They see reality. They're not psychotic, but they react to it badly. They're emotional and obsessive and over, just like alcoholics. Unless something happens, if they are intense enough, if something happens to alter the pattern, they will snap and become what is known as psychotic, where, to oversimplify it, the brain puts down an artificial view of things to reduce the conflict. You see things differently than other people do, but it resolves the conflict. And once you become psychotic, you don't hardly ever come back, no matter what he tells you. Once you're psychotic, you're usually there forever. Now, this rarely happens to alcoholics. Isn't that funny? Alcoholics almost never become psychotic. Now, you think that's strange, because, my God, they say it's the second greatest cause of insanity. But not that kind of insanity. The insanity that's caused by is when you drink enough, long enough, to deteriorate enough brain cells, you get what is known as alcoholic insanity. And if you've ever seen a case of alcoholic insanity, you wish you hadn't. Because they don't run around saying silly things at meetings. They sit in a ward somewhere and people change their diapers and feed them three times a day and put them to bed and get them up in the morning and change their diapers and feed them, and they never, ever, ever get better because the brain doesn't recreate itself. That's what alcoholic insanity is. Pray to God you don't ever see one. But alcoholics almost never snap and become psychotic. Why not? Because when it gets bad enough, long enough, they'll take a few drinks to reduce the pressure. So that begs the question, why don't these neurotics have a few drinks and reduce the pressure? And the point is that they do, it turns out. And there is the other end of alcoholism. Alcohol somehow relieves the pressure in some people that it doesn't do in most people. Alcohol, it turns out, does something special for me that it doesn't do for most people, and I never would have guessed it if I had thought of it 1,000 years. Alcohol almost instantly alters my perception of reality. Alcohol almost instantly alters my relationship to my environment. Alcohol almost instantly makes me larger and more self-contained and them smaller and less threatening, which gives us the one thing we all have in common. The great obsession is that somehow, someday, we will control and enjoy our drinking. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. And you will never understand the persistence of that illusion unless you can come to remember that without alcohol, life is untenable. I must find a way to control and enjoy it, because that's all I got. And it's more impressive than all the arguments, all the people. I've taken vows that if there were any way I could take... I remember one many years ago, my father had to come to my jail cell and say, well, you were out drunk last night, you let your little son die in his crib. He said, I don't want you to make me sick. And 3 days later, just suffused with guilt and agony, and I was in a little coal cemetery in Wisconsin, and I was, as you do then, I hadn't done any great crime, but I felt people were apparently sympathetic, but if you're like me, you understand the look of accusation in their eyes. Look what you did this time. And I insisted on taking his little casket and becoming his only pallbearer to somehow alleviate my grief, and I carried him over to this little house where they're going to store him until the ground thawed and they could bury him. I remember standing there by myself and putting my hand on his casket and saying, John, this will never happen again. This will never, ever, ever happen again. I will not drink anymore, and I will be good to your sisters and your mother. And inside of a month, I was up all night thinking about his death, and it got so bad I had to drink to stand it. And never could understand why. You drink to reduce conflict, even if the conflict is caused by your drinking. And away you go. And I don't, my emotions aren't different, they're just more, they're what we call alcoholic emotions turn out to be almost immature emotions. That's why I think they can make a case sometimes by saying, when alcohol began working for you, your emotional growth began to atrophy. Your intellect keeps going and your body keeps going, but you're, sometimes it's funny seeing old people coming to AA with emotions almost like children, and they're smart. And it seems to vary. Some people drink for 30 years before alcohol has this effect, and you never even know if you've got it. That's what they mean, I think, by crossing the line. You only know you've crossed the line in retrospect, and most people never even know they crossed the line. They just know that things are stinking. But some people drink for 30 years before they cross that line. Some people drink the first time out of the barrel, and it does it for them. That's why we have such a wide diversity of ages in AA, I think. You see it meeting sometimes. You see some old fool get up the podium, you'll say something like, I drank for 35 years. And look accusingly at some little snot about 22 in the front row, as if to say, how can you be an alcoholic? I drank longer than you were alive. And what he doesn't know, the little snot is looking up thinking, you can't be much of an alcoholic if you lasted 35 years, you old son of a bitch. It doesn't seem to make any difference how long, that's what they mean, it doesn't make how long you drank or where you drank. It's what it begins to do something for you. And when it does that something for you, it gradually, every time it works for you, it little by little reduces your ability to cope with conflict. And that's why way over 95% of people like you and me will die from it, and most of them will never believe they're alcoholics. I sit and talk to men who are literally dying, and they explain to me why they're not really alcoholics. And their livers stick out their hair, and their eyeballs are yellow, and they explain to me why they're not alcoholics. Now, if they can believe they're not alcoholics, a guy who's working downtown can certainly defend he's not an alcoholic, or a person who's holding it together or raising children or doing something. And the reason that's important is because it is, unless you understand that, AA doesn't seem to have any purpose. The purpose of AA is, it turns out, is to somehow make some alterations in my perception of reality. The reason that I have had no therapy since 1958 except Alcoholics Anonymous. I have not become a wonderful man. I have become a very, I'm still emotional, and I tend to have a tendency to go off the deep end once in a while, but I haven't had to drink or take a pill, which tells me something dramatic is changing, and every year it gets a little bit better. And so I know that Alcoholics Anonymous, the therapies of AA will work. But sometimes, even today, they come under scrutiny and question. Probably the biggest conflict that I know of today about AA is AA really necessary now that we have such good treatment centers? I'm not putting them down. I come from an era when there weren't any treatment centers when I got sober. There were sanitariums, Shire's Dryer, and places like that, but there were no treatment centers. And so I was raised in an era where people who believed in treatment centers, they were weaklings and pukes is what they were. Come on, be a man, go to AA, shake it up. And I was trained that way. And I'll tell you something. As the years have gone by, I have gradually, much to my surprise, come little by little to begrudgingly believe in some treatment centers. And I despise others. But I understand the reason for them. I think that, you know, it's an analogy I was thinking about a few months ago. Why would people go to a treatment center and just go to AA? It's just like if we were to go down to the shores of the Atlantic at Savannah and say, I want to go to Hilton Head, South Carolina Island. And here's a nice little skiff. It said, SS Treatment Center. There's a guy in a white uniform and the smell of good victuals. We have clean sheets and a nice bed. Won't you come with us? And down here on the beach are two guys skulking in the underbrush. You want to come with us in our invisible boat? Nobody who has an alternative wants to go with two pukes like that. And you get on that SS treatment center, and it's great. And it's fine. And they do give you a respite. And it's wonderful. And it's good. The only problem is, you get out just out of sight of land, and they say, well, we've got to turn back now and get the next load. But I'm not where I'm going. Well, you're rested. Swim like hell. You swim like hell, and pretty soon here comes these two fools up in their invisible boat. You wanna ride, buddy? I'm not that sick. And pretty soon you start to go down. And here they come again. Wanna ride in our invisible boat? Yeah. And you get in, and as soon as you dry off, you realize, this is stupid. There's no boat here. These guys are floating. It's craziness. What am I supposed to do? Grab an oar and row. Finally, they come by again, and you're drowned. You want to ride my invisible boat?
Yes. What am I supposed to do?
Grab an oar and row.
No, you crazy bastard.
And the irony of AA is, as you row, the boat appears. But if you don't row, it never appears, and you believe there never was any boat there at all. And pretty soon, if you row long enough, you get a much better boat than anything you've ever seen. And the other sad thing about it is, no matter how long you've been rowing or how big your boat is, if you stop rowing, it begins to disappear again. Just little by little. There are people like me, and perhaps like you, who ever so often I'm caught up in my magnificence. I've helped so many bastards. I sometimes caught myself a few months ago not going to meetings as often as I went. And what happened? I didn't get drunk. Nothing happened. My perceptions got distorted, and I took some actions that I shouldn't have taken. And when I realized that, I went back and started rowing again, and things got better. And it's just a funny thing. No matter how long you've been sober or how much you know, you cannot afford to do that very long. You don't get drunk, but things look different. You have a different conception of your own self and your rights and your abilities to have what you want. And that's what sponsors are for, in a sense, you know. They come along from time to time and say, hey, you got your oar upside down. Oh. No wonder you're not getting anywhere, yeah. Now, the difference, I would say, between a good treatment center and a bad treatment center, and there are plenty of both, is this. A good treatment center says, we can help you get rested. We can give you a start. But I'll tell you something. Keep your eyes open for two fools in an invisible boat. And jump in. And the lethal ones are the ones who give the implication, you are now well, go back to life. They literally kill people. And there are still hospitals that's where I live who are using as their ultimate the aversion therapy. One big one used the aversion therapy only in the last few months has allowed AA to come in, and that's because they're not getting any cured. And I know they're doing all right. They just sold for $64 million 2 months ago. So somebody's making a lot of dough watching people die. And this is not a blanket indictment of treatment centers. I think treatment centers are absolutely wonderful. I used an AA club for a month. I sat in there day after day and didn't go outside. And people then said, these are AA club bums. And I was an AA club bum. But I couldn't face the world. I needed the respite. But the purpose of AA, the purpose of having a sponsor, to superimpose perceptions over yours when your emotions are distorted to tell you how it really is, of going to these meetings, of working these steps little by little, and no matter how hard you work them or how good you become, you never rise. This is a great disappointment. You never rise above basic human being. And you know, and human beings are fallible and emotional, and sometimes they don't live up to their own standards by any means. And that's why what's good about AA is that every night is New Year's Eve. You could say, tomorrow I'm going to do it better. Some people have to wait 364 days for their New Year's resolutions to kick in. I have to wait tomorrow morning when I kneel to talk to God as I've come to believe in Him in AA and explain to Him I'm a weak and fallible person, and the way I saw things wasn't right. I'm going to try to do it better tomorrow. And it enables me to live mostly in peace. But I don't suppose any human being can live totally in peace. I think it's sometimes funny. Sometimes we talk in AA about the goal of AA is to find endless serenity. Just let me find serenity, peace. You know, I have never met an alcoholic that I, in my opinion, could stand serenity 2 straight days. Yeah. You may say at the end of your second day, I have found the serenity I'm looking for. Without any apparent motivation on your own part, your other hand just dips into the septic tank and starts to stir. Just why, look at there. That's why we have to keep rowing. That's what these AA is. It's a way to keep rowing. And you're never going to become perfect, so you're going to rest on your oars sometimes. And sometimes you're going to diminish yourself. And sometimes you're not going to be as nice as you were other times. And sometimes you can help people, and sometimes you're too selfish. And sometimes you get... But the point is, you got to row. I still think the best way I know to describe the purpose of AA, the reason they say action is the magic word, is action brings the perceptions that give you love and some belief and understanding. This group I belong to in Los Angeles, the chairman said this was somewhat larger than his home group. My home group is half this big, 600 every Wednesday night. The largest group in the world, I guess, the Pacific group. And some years ago, I had the privilege of starting that group. I started because I had been defeated in the election in another group. Not defeated in the election. My nomination died for lack of a second. Put it that way. Well... So I built this group. I was secretary for a year, and they wanted an election. I said, no, I don't think you people are ready for self-government. So I was secretary another year. I built that baby up to 45 or 48 members in 2.5 years, just by charisma. I thought I'd let them see what it could be like otherwise. They got a new secretary in, and now it's up to 600. Well, funny break. But, you know, I sit in that meeting now. Every Wednesday night's my home group. And I sit in the back like founders do, and I give little signals. Nobody ever pays any attention, but it makes me feel lonely. And after the meeting, I stand in the back and I try to look like a founder should look, you know, just, hi, how are you? You new? Once in a while, some pupil come up who doesn't know who I am. I said, hey, buddy, could you give me a ride back over to the VA psycho ward? The nice part about AA is I can look him in the eye, and as my sponsor told me 24 years ago, you can think whatever you want to. I can look him right in the eye and think, you simpleton, sick puke. Yeah. There's 599 people in this room who need action desperately. There is one who has been drained dry, who has given everything. You know, I'm not just some goof of the car. I'm Clancy Eye from Up in the Sky. What is this? I can think all that as long as I say, okay. And the nice part about AA is, after I drop that puke off and I'm driving home, my mind says, Clancy, is there no end to your goodness? I am telling you, I have not become a wonderful person, but I have become the best person I've ever become. And I've got a ways to go. That's why I'm still active. I got to remember that my goal here is not to speak well. My goal is not to look slick, although I sometimes forget both these things. My goal is to take continuing actions that keep my perceptions and keep my priorities straight. When I do that, I live at peace. When I don't, it becomes uncomfortable again. That's why I'm glad to be here this weekend. I enjoyed... Once you start thinking about that, you could identify with every speaker. I really always tell Harold, he gives a great talk. He talks about things I believe in. He talks about the basic verities. And I believe in them because making them complex just makes it more difficult. It's simple. I cannot live in sobriety without help. And the only help that works for people like me is here. And if I do not choose to use it, I must certainly have a very, very bad life. That's why I'm glad to be here tonight. I'm glad to be safe and sane and sober. I'm glad tomorrow I'll spend it with my father, a man I didn't talk to for 10 years. And my children are growing up and all gone. And I hate that. I feel like a dope anymore in AA because all the parents get up and talk about their children in AA and they clap for them. And I got 5 kids and none of them ever drank or took pills. I say, what's wrong with you goddamn kids? When I was your age, I was in the insane asylum. But there's still hope for them. They're on the faculties of universities ready to make their move. But I'm glad to be here. I want to thank the committee for having me. I've really enjoyed the hospitality. I just love Atlanta. And I love everything about the people in it because I think you feel the way I feel. There's something to do, and we can do it. We can do it together. Thank you.